The Clark Sickle Leaf Carpet holds the record for the most expensive rug in the world. It's a Persian rug, and in 2013, it got that title by going at an auction for the staggering amount of $33.7 million for a rug. But when you look at it, and I was looking at pictures this week, you can see there is an extraordinary amount of craftsmanship that goes into this. It's got all these different colors, and they're deep. It's got some reds. It's got these blues. There's this intricate vine pattern woven throughout it, flowers all around. And the feature is what they call the sickle leaf. It's a leaf that's kind of curved, and that pattern is all throughout this rug. But below the pattern is an amazing thought that there are thousands upon thousands of hand-tied knots that go into making such a mesmerizing design. The craftsmanship is amazing. But when I think about how interwoven that rug is and how intricate it is, I cannot help but think about the Bible. It makes me think about how interconnected the Bible is, all the different parts working together. I read this week that some people estimate that there are 63,000 cross-references in the Bible. A cross-reference is where some place in the Bible refers to another place in the Bible. It could be the Old Testament and the New Testament or within them. And not only are there cross-references, but there's hundreds and thousands of images and symbols and themes repeated throughout the Bible. And something that I've learned over the years when studying the Bible is when you see one of those repeated themes or patterns, pay attention. Pay attention to those repeated patterns. And this happened to me in the last few weeks. I was studying, and I saw a pattern that I had never seen before. I was reading in Genesis, and I was reading Joseph's story. He's the guy with the multicolored cloak. And I'm reading his story, and I stumble on something, and I said, this kind of sounds like Daniel. If you know Daniel in the lion's den. So I kept reading, and then another time, this seems like Daniel. And another, Daniel, what is going on? So I looked it up. I'm not the only one who's found this. But I dug into the similarities. They are astounding. Let me just give you a few. Joseph and Daniel. Both of these young men are taken as young men out of their homes. Both of them are sent into exile into foreign countries. Both Joseph and Daniel are tested and tempted while they're there. Both Joseph and Daniel are said to have God's favor upon them. And they're both said to have a divine spirit in them. Both Joseph and Daniel have the unique ability to interpret other people's dreams. And both Joseph and Daniel are in a place where the king has a dream that troubles him, and neither king can interpret it, and none of the magicians of the king can interpret it. And both Joseph and Daniel are called to interpret the dream, which they do correctly. And because of that, they're both raised to these prominent places in the kingdom. Now, come on. This is not a coincidence. This is intentional. But I was asking the Lord, I was praying, okay, what's the point? What are you trying to show us? What's the pattern pointing to? And the key that unlocked this is when I realized the places that they were sent. So Joseph is sent to Egypt, and Daniel is sent to Babylon. And if you know Egypt and Babylon in the Bible, they are not good places. Egypt is seen as a place of oppression and slavery. Babylon becomes to represent basically the enemies of God, the forces against God. Ultimately, both of these places represent a picture of the world. So here's what I came to see that I believe God is showing us, that Joseph and Daniel are two examples of how it is that we are to live in the world, but not of it. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to take a look at the stories of Joseph and Daniel, just small portions of it, And we're going to be looking at some of these similarities, and we're going to see how do they go about living in the world but staying out of it. So turn with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 39. And we're going to be going from here in Genesis to Daniel, so just, you know, bear with me as we go back and forth. Genesis 39. And before Genesis 39, two chapters before this, we learn a little bit about Joseph. We learn that Joseph is 17 years old, and we learn that Joseph's brothers hate him. They absolutely despise him. And because they hate him, they want to kill him. But one of the brothers says, okay, let's not kill him. Let's at least make a little money off of him. So they sell Joseph, their brother, into slavery. Okay, so we pick this up now in Genesis 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So Joseph is a young man, 17, he's a teenager, taken from his home, placed in a foreign land, basically treated like a product. He is bought, like cattle. Okay, he's in this foreign land, a completely new environment, a completely new culture, a different language. Can you imagine what he would be feeling? Confused, scared, fearful, overwhelmed. I'm sure many of you have the feeling of your first day on the job. Maybe it's your first job, or do you ever remember switching jobs? Your first day on the job, maybe those first weeks or months, you're kind of trying to figure everything out. It could be overwhelming. You got a boss, you got to figure him or her out. You got coworkers. You're trying to figure out, where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to do? I want to do the right things. It can be overwhelming. And I remember my first job ever. Many of you probably remember the restaurant Tony Angelo's. I was a busboy at Tony Angelo's, my first job ever. And I learned on day one a few things. I learned my boss had a temper. I learned it was a very fast pace in a restaurant. And so I was just trying my best to stay alive, stay out of the fray. I didn't want to step on anybody's toes. I was just trying to do my best. And I was doing pretty good until I learned the hard way that in a restaurant, the door between the dining room and the kitchen, it goes both ways. And so I'm coming in to the door, a waiter's coming out of the door, and he hits that door, and at the last second I realize, this thing is coming at me, and so somehow I dodged it and I survived. But it was a chaotic moment, and it was overwhelming. But I want you to understand, that is only a little bit of what Joseph is feeling. Joseph is in a whole new land, completely out of his element, completely different language. They're yelling at him in the Egyptian language. He speaks Hebrew. He doesn't even know what they're saying. So just think to yourself, how would you respond in this type of situation? What would be going in through your mind? How would you handle it? I think it would be natural in a situation like this to kind of almost isolate yourself. Like, I'm just going to do the minimum I can to not get in trouble or not get killed. Right? I'm not going to try to overexert myself. Maybe to the language you're like, okay, I'll learn a few words, but like, just the minimum. So I have that excuse. Like, I don't speak Egyptian, you know, don't ask me any questions. But this is not what Joseph does. He does not isolate himself. In fact, what we're going to learn, the first thing here is that Joseph proactively engages in this world. He engages in the world that he's been put. So let's continue. Look at verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. So Joseph, at some point, he decides, I'm not going to isolate myself from this situation. I'm going to trust God, and I'm going to engage in this world. I'm going to learn the language. I'm going to learn it better than anybody else. I'm going to get involved. I'm going to learn Potiphar's estate. Potiphar's a wealthy man. There's a lot of business to do. I'm going to learn it all. Joseph throws himself in, and he engages. Okay? So this is Joseph. Joseph proactively engages. Now let's go think about Daniel. So come with me now. Hold your place. Let's go to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. Now, so interesting about Daniel, just number one here, is that Joseph and Daniel are separated by about 1,000 years. There's a long time in between the history of Joseph and Daniel. And it's interesting, they're both kind of like bookends of Israel's history. Joseph at the beginning and Daniel at the end, yet their stories are so similar. Look at Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So the king of Babylon comes to Jerusalem and attacks. And God has said this was going to happen. He foretold this because Judah and Israel had forsaken God and they were following idols. Okay, now pick it up in verse 3. Then the king ordered Aspenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, who had ability for serving in the king's court. And here's what he says. He ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. So again, a young man taken from his home, sent to a foreign land. And Joseph kind of seems like he has to figure it out on his own, but here with Daniel, the Babylonians are intentionally re-educating them. It says that for 3 years they're going to teach them the literature, so all the writings, and the language of the Babylonians. And this is intentional. They do this to try to erase their previous culture. They want to re-educate them. And I know if you're a parent, you probably have gone or are going through this process of figuring out how are you going to educate your children? Are you going to put them in a school? Are you going to homeschool them? You can put them in high school. And what about college? We all know that fear of you send your kid to college and they come back brainwashed. So you know the education here, this is a risky situation. Dr. Reynold Showers, a graduate of DTS, in his book, The Most High God, here's what he says. These men were put under the instruction of elite but ungodly teachers, men who were regarded as the world's top scholars. A situation that could be deadly for the faith of an impressionable teen. So this is a risky situation. How's Daniel and his friends going to handle it? Are they going to isolate themselves? Avoid this? Back out? No. Actually, they do the opposite. Daniel and his friends get proactively engaged in the world they live to such a degree that they are 10 times better, it says, than all the even natives who are there. Come, look with me at verse 20. At the end of the 3 years, Nebuchadnezzar comes and he's testing these men to see how they were trained. So Daniel 1, verse 20. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. Can you imagine the work it took to become 10 times better, speaking the language and understanding the literature of native people in their own country? Now, of course, God's involved here, no doubt. But they are applying themselves. They are choosing to engage in this situation. So the first thing we see is Joseph and Daniel, they do not back out of the cultures they're in. They choose to engage. So they choose to engage. Now, I think the question some of you might be asking is, well, how far do you go with this? Engaging in the world, engaging in the culture. Isn't that risky? Isn't that a risky thing to get so engaged in the world? And I would say, yeah, it is risky. We know from the Old Testament, God repeatedly tells his people, don't intermarry with the people of the other lands. Why? Because they're going to draw you away from worshiping me. They're going to draw you away. And we know the prime example of this is Solomon. He's supposed to be the wisest man around. Yet Solomon, he accumulates 1,000 wives and concubines. And what does it say towards the end of his reign? They turned his heart away from God. Away from wholehearted devotion to God. And again, in the New Testament, we hear this refrain. James 1 says, keep oneself unstained by the world. Unstained. And 1 Peter 2 says, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from the fleshly lusts that wage war against the soul. So certainly, there is a balance going on. They're going to engage in the world, but what we're going to see is Joseph and Daniel keep themselves unstained by it. Engaged, but unstained. So come, let's go back to Genesis 39. We're going to go back to Joseph. And we're going to pick this up at verse 6, at the end of verse 6. So again, Joseph, he's in Potiphar's house right now. Things are going well until we get to the end of verse 6. It says, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And let me just stop. I just think that's interesting. Joseph also is handsome. And if you noted, Daniel, it said they were handsome. Choose the good-looking guys. So we've got Joseph and Daniel. But Joseph here, this is ominous. He's handsome. Verse 7. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. And she said, lie with me. So things are as good as they could be in slavery for Joseph. He's having some success. And here comes the world trying to stain him. Potiphar's wife, she starts making advances on Joseph. He's young, he's handsome, he's successful. Who knows where Potiphar is, if he's busy all the time? She starts to advance on Joseph. And just think about Joseph's situation. Again, he's a young man. I said he was 17 when he was sold into slavery, but it's been a few years. He's probably in his early 20s. So this is a young man in his early 20s, far from home. There ain't nobody around. Kind of sounds like college. But you see the risk here. Who would even know? Who would even know if he did this? Who would keep him accountable? You could even think he might even be saying, if I don't do this, I might get in trouble. She might cause issues for me. Or you could even see, maybe he says to himself, maybe he's resentful of God. He's like, God, how did you let all this happen? I'm 1,000 miles from my home, by myself, all this is going on. I don't know if you've ever felt this, but when things seem to be going wrong in your life, you could even ask, like, why does it even matter staying faithful to God? What does it matter to stay righteous? Who cares? But that's not what Joseph does. Look at verse 8. But he refused, and he said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? So in a foreign land, Joseph is reasoning to himself. He talks about his master. He's like, Potiphar has done good things for me. I'm going to sin against him. But more importantly, how can I sin against God? Far from home, he remembers, sin is sin against God. And God still sees. Nobody else would see, but God would see. And so Joseph is able to stay unstained by the world because he stays close to God. He stays unstained because he's staying close to God. Okay, now let's go back to Daniel. Hold your place and go back to Daniel chapter 1. We're going to pick Daniel up in verse 5. Let's see how Daniel's situation progresses. So they're going to be taught the literature and the language. And then verse 5, the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they would enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name of Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. New location, new language, new food, new names. The Babylonians were doing everything they could to stain Daniel and his friends. They were trying to get them to forget their past and come into this new way of thinking, the Babylonian way of thinking. And the names is crucial. You know, your name kind of has a bit of your identity. More so for them, they rename them. So again, Daniel's in a situation. What's he going to do? He's been pretty engaged. He's learning all this stuff. Where is he going to draw the line? Look at verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So Daniel makes up his mind. He sets his heart to this, it says. He has a firm resolution. I'm going to get involved. I'm going to learn. But I'm not going to defile myself with your food. Now, to us, that could be kind of strange. Does anybody else think it's kind of strange? Like, that's where you're going to draw the line? He's putting all this delicious food, some filet mignon in front of you, not going to eat it? That's the place? And it's, you know, it's odd, too, because we know from the New Testament, we can eat whatever we want. Everything's clean to us. But that is not how it was for them in the Old Testament. The Jews in the Old Testament, their food laws were extremely important to them. Extremely. Here's what former pastor and author Alistair Begg, here's how he says. In the Old Testament, one of the distinguishing features of God's people was the rules they followed about what they would and would not eat and drink. And he continues, dietary choices were an external outworking of their deeply held convictions about what it means to belong to God. So these young men in this situation, given where they were and what they were doing and what they were being called, the last thread tying them to their Jewish roots and their faith was dietary. And so Daniel chooses to not be stained here, and he refuses. He refuses. And I do find it kind of funny the way he refuses. He doesn't cause a big rebellion. He doesn't revolt. He just kind of politely asks the commander. He's like, hey, like, I don't want to do this. He's very nice about it. And I kind of feel for the commander in a way, because it says God gives Daniel favor in his sight. So the commander, he's like, wait a second. Okay, you're telling me, Daniel, you're the slaves that we captured, we own you, and you're going to tell me, go to Nebuchadnezzar, who himself has a temper, and I'm supposed to go to Nebuchadnezzar and say, hey, you know those slaves that we got? And you remember, like, all that food we spent hours preparing? Yeah, they want a different menu. Do you have, like, a vegetarian menu? He's like, I'm going to lose my head if I do this. But Daniel talks to him and agrees and says, just give us a period of time. Just test us for 10 days, and then you can determine what, how we look. And so let's see how this works out for them. Look at verse 14. So the commander, so he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and wine that they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. So it ends up working out. He has held the line and he's chosen to be unstained. So with Joseph and with Daniel, we see that they engage in the world, but they stay unstained by the world. And they do it by staying close to their God. So, okay, we get to this point, and, you know, as I was studying this, it's like, man, you start thinking, this is a lot of effort for them. Because they continue this throughout their whole lives. Like, there's many other episodes in these stories where they're engaging, they're rising in prominence, but something happens that's risky. They choose to not do it because it will defile themselves, or they'll forfeit, you know, God or something. All the way. Like, this is a lot of effort. And you almost can say, like, what is the point of this? Why are they going through these lengths? But there is a point. And the point is that Joseph and Daniel came to realize they were not in these places on accident. It was not accidental that they ended up here. They were here on purpose. They were here on purpose. So what they come to find out is that they are supposed to see themselves as sent there for God's purposes. To see themselves as being sent to these places for God's purposes. This is bigger than just them. So if you come with me, this will be the last time we go. Let's go back to Genesis. Genesis 45 this time, though. Let's go see. How does this kind of culminate? Genesis 45. And let me just give you a recap. So Joseph, we just read he was in Potiphar's house, okay? And the story goes, he goes from Potiphar's house, and things don't get better at first. They get worse. He goes to prison. But then while in prison, he's called, and he interprets the dreams of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh raises him up to second in the kingdom. And the dreams that he interpreted were basically saying, Pharaoh, there's going to be 7 years of abundance in Egypt, followed by 7 years of famine. And what you need to do, Pharaoh, is you need to store up food in the years of abundance, so you'll have food in the years of famine. And he gets put in charge of this whole thing. And what's amazing is that back home, Joseph's brothers and father, they start running out of food. And so they end up coming to Egypt looking for food. And when they come there, Joseph recognizes them, and they don't recognize Joseph. And if you know the story, he puts his brothers through quite the elaborate set of tests to see if their character has changed from when they sold him. And then eventually, when he can't control it anymore, Joseph reveals his identity to his brothers. And this is where we're going to pick it up in chapter 45, verse 4. It says, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come closer to me.' And they came closer. And he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God.'" What's the repetition here? You didn't send me here. God sent me here. Joseph came to realize he was sent here on purpose by God. And if you know the story, the whole story of Genesis, it really is a mind-blowing fact that from the beginning of Genesis, Adam and Eve, when they fall, God gives this prophecy that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the seed of the serpent. Meaning, somebody is going to come from the line of Eve who is going to destroy the enemy. Okay? And then as the story, the whole story of Genesis follows this pattern. And you get to Abraham, where God says, "Abraham, the seed is going to come through you." And then he goes to Isaac, "It's going to come through you." And to Jacob, "It will be through you." And Jacob has the 12 sons. At this point, we don't exactly know, well, which of the 12 sons is it? But what we do know is that that seed is in danger of extinction because of the coming famine. This famine was so widespread that even in the land of Israel, they were feeling it. And the seed could have been extinct if they had died without food. So think about this. God used Joseph to save the very brothers who sold him into slavery. And he did it for his bigger purpose of preserving that seed, the promised seed, the deliverer. This was much bigger than Joseph, and he had to come to see that he was sent here. And now what about Daniel? Very similar. We learn in Jeremiah 29, Jeremiah is a prophet. He's writing to the exiles in Babylon, and he says, "God sent you there. God sent you there." And we know part of the reason for the Babylonian exile is that they were worshiping idols, and so this was a punishment. But God sent them there, and it even says in Jeremiah, basically here's what it says, "Get comfortable, pray for the city, and be a blessing while you're there. That's essentially what he's telling them. Now, can you imagine this? These people have killed your family and friends, whisked you away to a foreign country, they're treating you harshly, and God's telling you, I sent you there. Pray for the city. Be a blessing to the city. It's amazing. And Daniel himself, he's specifically there because he kind of rises up and he's like who all the Jews are looking to. And Daniel stands in front of multiple kings in Babylon telling all of them, our God is the real king. He's the Most High God. Even in these situations that we're in, he controls everything. So Daniel's encouraging the exiles, and Daniel uses his authority and his influence to keep them safe. So both Joseph and Daniel are sent to these places for God's higher purposes. Now, remember what I said in the beginning about paying attention to patterns? There's another pattern we need to see here. Of all the people in the Old Testament is not, it doesn't hold any punches with showing the flaws of its major characters. Every single major character has a flaw that we see. Abraham has flaws. Moses has flaws. David has flaws. But guess what? Joseph and Daniel are the only two in the Old Testament not portrayed as having any major flaws. Now hear me, I'm not saying that they're sinless, but the way they're portrayed in the book, no major flaws. Why is this? It's because Joseph doesn't just point to Daniel. Joseph and Daniel point to someone else. Someone else who is flawless. Someone else who was sent into the world. Someone else who was tempted but resisted. And unjustly accused and cruelly treated. Someone else who raised to power and authority and used that authority to save others. Joseph and Daniel point to Jesus. That pattern is intentional. Jesus is the perfect example of living in the world, but not of it. Think about a few things. Jesus came from heaven into our world. Basically, that's an exile, because look what Jesus himself says. He says, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He's homeless. Jesus proactively engaged with the world. He didn't isolate himself from certain people. He talked to men. He talked to women. He talked to Jews, Gentiles, Romans. He talked to the rich people. He talked to the poor people. He spent so much time eating and drinking with tax collectors, prostitutes, and sinners that people, you know what they actually said? The rumor went around. This man's a glutton and a drunkard. Jesus. He engaged perfectly, yet he stayed unstained by the world. It couldn't stain him. In Hebrews it reads, he was one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. And Jesus was sent for God's ultimate purpose. The unstained one was sent to take the stain that we have from sin upon himself. And he did it so that when he rose from the dead, now, by placing our trust in him, God can look at us as unstained. How amazing is this? But I want to go a little step farther. Joseph and Daniel, they point to Jesus. But guess what? It doesn't stop with Jesus. Because here's what Jesus says, his own words in John 17. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And he's talking to his disciples, but this applies to us. Jesus, the unstained one, now sends us into the world. And you might be saying, like, okay, what do you mean by sent into the world? Like, where am I supposed to go? Where am I supposed to go somewhere? No, think about it. Joseph and Daniel were relocated. They changed locations in order to change cultures. But we have stayed in the same place, but the culture has changed around us. We do not live in the same culture we lived in 50, 60 years ago. This is a different world we live. So in a very similar way, we are like exiles in the world we live right now. And yet Jesus is sending us to engage in this world. We are to engage, but we also are to stay unstained. And we're to do it for God's higher purpose. How amazing is that? So let me just close here with a few questions for you to think about. And talk about it. Ask yourself this. Number one, do I tend to isolate myself too much from the world? Like, do I not engage in the world at all? Do I go too far that way? And I would say, personally, I can lean this way. You know, you stay away from all the news and this and that. You isolate yourself. Okay, do I isolate myself? Number two, or do I go the other way? Have I become too engaged in the world that I don't look anything different from it? Have I become stained by it? Has it pulled me into its mold? Okay? Have I gone one way or the other? And number three, do I see myself as being sent wherever I am by Jesus? Do I view myself that wherever you are, in your workplace, in your family, all these places, I'm actually sent here on purpose by Jesus? So think about those things over the next week. Would you pray with me? Father, thank you for these wonderful stories. I love every time I stumble on things like this in your word that are purposely put here by you. It shows your design, your hand in this book. I pray, Father, that we would take this to heart, that we would examine ourselves to figure out which way do I go? Am I too isolated? Am I too engaged? Do I view myself as sent? Father, help us to realize none of us are going to do this perfectly. Nobody can engage perfectly and still stay unstained perfectly, except for Christ. And he did it on our behalf. So that now, Lord, as he sends us into the world, we give it our best shot, always just resting on him and his Holy Spirit. Father, thank you for this time. Help this word to change us, to become more like you. In your name we pray. Amen.